Welcome to the Way Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Trofesky. This is FM 91.7 WHUS Taurus at the top of the hour. For more, go to podcasttheway.com. Now, today's topic is death row. And I'm sitting with Tessie Castillo, who is a writer and has recently published a book called Crimson Letters, Voices from Death Row. How's it going, Tessie?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming out. And we're going to have another guest call in probably about 10 minutes who's currently on death row, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. Well, can you tell me a little bit about yourself? What made you want to get involved with this research?
Sure. So it wasn't research. I actually got involved with death row completely by accident. The Super Bowl was the medium. I was at a Super Bowl party back in 2013 and happened to run into a guy who was a psychologist who worked on death row in Central Prison here in Raleigh, North Carolina, which is where everyone on death row is housed in the state. And he had told me that he was starting up some programs on death row for the first time. Previously, they didn't allow in outsiders, no volunteers. There was no rehabilitative programming going on death row. But he had started up some classes. And so I volunteered to teach a writing class. And it took about a year to go through the approval process. But I was eventually approved and I got into the prison. And I started teaching about 20 of the roughly 140 men who were on death row. And in the writing class, they wrote about how they got to death row, how they had grown since they had been there, what their hopes and struggles were. And so I really got to know them. And I was impressed with what I saw. There were certainly some of them that seemed to have lost hope. And I saw them in the class. But there were others who, despite being on death row 10 years, 20 years, even 30 years in one case, they had a lot of hope and they had done a lot of self-reflection and a lot of growing since they had been there. And they had insight and wisdom. And I was so impressed that I wrote a letter to the local newspaper, basically advocating for the humanity on death row. And after that, about a week later, I received a very terse letter from the warden of the prison telling me that my services were no longer required and they canceled my class. I started writing to several of the guys who had been my students, and we just wrote letters back and forth for a couple of years. And again, the letters were just really, were very wise and very humble, and I learned a lot from them. And so I decided that I wanted to share this writing with the world and proposed to four of the men that we put together a book, and that became Crimson Letters.
So your book is a combination of these letters you've written with different inmates on death row?
Yeah, it's mostly essays that they wrote. So the essays are about how they got to prison, what their lives were like growing up, and then their search for a sense of purpose since they've been in prison. It's very important to each of them that their lives be meaningful, even within prison. And so that's what they write about mostly.
Nice. A lot of these people, state inmates, are going to die. So almost why bother with the education?
We're all going to die. I don't think that, some of them might be executed, but actually in North Carolina, 71% of people who are sentenced to death eventually have their sentence overturned, meaning they're taken off of death row. 71%. Yes.
That's a huge percent.
Huge.
Why is it so high?
Because there's so many mistakes that are made during the trials. So that doesn't mean that 71% are innocent or that 71% get let out back into the community, but their sentence is overturned. So for some of them, that means they're then sentenced to life in prison or perhaps a reduced sentence. Although several of them, yes, they are actually found innocent and released. And nationally, that number is 65% of death penalty cases are overturned. So it's still the majority, even across the country. This is actually Lyle calling right now.
Oh, all right. Sounds good.
Hello. How are you? Good morning. No worries. I'll just patch you right in. Hello, can you hear us? Hello.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
How's it going?
How's it going, Lyle? We got you on the line now?
Yep.
Are you currently in North Carolina?
Yes, I've been in North Carolina Central Prison for the last 21 years. Been incarcerated in North Carolina since 1997. When I was 19 years old.
How old are you now?
I'm 42, so a total of 23 years and counting.
What setting are you in? What do you currently see? Give the audience a little picture.
Okay, so I'm sitting in the day room. There's about maybe 8 people at the day room. Half of them are watching a really bad horror movie that probably shouldn't have been made. And the other half are watching appears to be a strongman competition on the other TV. Other people are, you know, kind of in their cells doing their own thing. And I'm the only person on the phone because there is only one phone in the day room. It's attached to the wall. Looks like an old fashioned payphone minus the coin slots. Crimson Letters has been a really interesting journey. I know my initial contributions to it, I felt like probably could have been better, but it ended up turning out pretty good. Well, especially, you know, the final two chapters that I wrote for it, Learning to Die and Teaching to Live, have certainly gained a lot of interest, especially Learning to Die, I think, largely because of the relationship expressed between Eddie and myself. It's not easy when you lose a friend to an execution, and I think that chapter, more than any I contributed, really expresses humanity.
So in that chapter, the sense I'm getting is you learn to accept death from one of your friends, it sounded like, was executed on death row?
Yes, Eddie Hartman, he was executed back a number of years ago. In 2003, it was a hard year because that year they had executed the most North Carolina had been put to death since its reinstatement of the death penalty in 1972. 7 people were put to death that year. And a number of them were friends of mine, people I was learning from and had grown close to. But Eddie's death was particularly hard because I saw him more as a peer than a particular mentor or like previous executions had been. And that made it harder because I saw in him a lot of the same things that I saw in myself, a lot of the same fears and, you know, just generally not knowing what it would mean to die. And I think that was a catalyst for me and really made me examine my life and my future.
Got it. Also, what's the general person like in death row?
The general person. So the general person in death row is kind of like any other prisoner. They're trying to make it, you know, they're trying to find ways to give meaning to their existence beyond, you know, just being in a cell and rotting. A lot of guys, they find things to do for themselves. You know, they'll draw, or maybe they'll play card games or board games that are available sometimes to watch TV. And while those don't seem like much, you kind of have to really micromanage your days so that you're not focused on the bigger picture issues. Because the less you're focused on those things and the more you're focused on what's immediately in front of you, it's kind of easier to do time like that. Because if you begin looking, I guess, at the forest as opposed to the trees, you tend to despair. Because just for example, say I were to 10 or 15 years ago, I were to look at, you know, gee, where will I be 10 years from now? Will I still be here in 10 years? You know, will I still be living? And if I am living in it and I'm still at this prison, what would that mean for me? You know, will I still have my mind intact and things like that? So, you know, that kind of struggle is what all of us here on death row go through. And it's kind of what a lot of prisoners go through who have those long-term sentences that are, you know, unlikely to end in release. The people who are sentenced to life with parole and life without parole and the de facto life sentences, because they're every bit the death sentence that, you know, being on death row is. They just, you know, will die in prison. And that's, you know, not a whole lot different from being on death row and dying in prison, except by execution. But, you know, as you probably have heard by now, North Carolina hasn't executed anybody since 2006. So what that means is we have to find ways to deal with these life sentences, that could potentially end up in execution, but most likely won't. So you have to find ways to, you know, bring meaning to that time. And it's not an easy thing to do. So as far as the people go, that's, you know, something that everyone is having to deal with. And I think if that were to put us all on the same footing, then that would be it. Beyond that, it's about personality and ability and intelligence. And, you know, that varies greatly, just like in any population.
You mentioned a little bit about it, but how much is the time spent looking back, like 10 years ago or even in the beginning, and how much is looking into the moment or even the future?
So as far as looking into the past, everybody does that every day. You don't live in prison and not look back at the past and say, you know, gee, what if I'd have done this different or that different? Prison necessitates regret. That's, you know, kind of its purpose. It doesn't matter if you couldn't have done anything differently, but the fact remains that you Monday morning quarterback everything in your life from early childhood all the way up to adulthood. And that is for every prisoner in every prison throughout the world. I firmly believe that. As far as the future goes, that's a little sketchier. It's harder to define a future on death row or if you're under a sentence of life imprisonment. But more so because death row has a great deal of uncertainty in our future, especially for those who don't have appeals left. And, you know, the de facto moratorium on the death penalty makes it, you know, really hard to know what's going to happen. And living like that, living with that, you know, kind of that not knowing is, it can be stressful. Anxiety provoking. And if you don't have things to keep yourself focused, to, you know, to stay in a spiritual mindset, to really do things that, you know, expand your mind, then you're going to lose it. And it's really that simple.
Is that what led you to writing, for example, this Voices from Death Row?
Part of it. But writing also was a way of communicating for me. I've been incarcerated most of my life. Even before my incarceration at the age of 19, I was in a youth detention center up in Maine for, you know, different periods, you know, just a few months here and a few months there, but it added up. And whenever I would go to the youth center, it was, you know, well, how do I talk to my parents, because there are no phones, or, you know, visits were I think every other weekend back then. And while my parents would come and see me, you know, there were things I needed to talk to them about, so I would have to write letters. And when I ultimately became incarcerated here in North Carolina, it was again, you know, necessary to write letters. And that was the only way I could communicate with people. There are no phones on death row. You have to write. So writing grew out of me to explain myself to people, to communicate with my family and get them to understand what this place is and, you know, how it affects me and how I'm sure it affects them. And, you know, they in turn would express their feelings to me. And, you know, while writing letters is certainly a way of communicating, it still doesn't say everything that I needed it to say. I ultimately ended up self-publishing a memoir called Waiting for the Last Train. And that was kind of a bigger endeavor that was discussing the early years of my life all the way up to my incarceration, and just as a way of trying to understand it myself and go through this cathartic process of, you know, just kind of digging through the past. And while it was helpful and it certainly got my A story out there, it wasn't the entire story, because I view writing as this attempt to grasp a certain period of time. And once you do that, once you put it out there, you know, of course, time has moved. You have changed, most likely. You evolve every moment of every day. And going back then, you know, looking at that particular memoir, I was like, well, okay, well, this doesn't cover everything. So then I with some help from friends,
You have 60 seconds remaining.
I ended up writing the blog beyondstilldoors.com, and that was more of a journaling effort that also grew out of Tessie's journaling class. She was largely kind of my muse for creating that particular writing format. But again, it was, you know, all practice, all leading up to this interest in...
You have 30 seconds remaining.
In publishing and getting more people to see the writing.
I think you can call us back, correct?
Yep. Hold on a sec.
Hey.
All right, Lyle, you're back in.
Okay. Hello?
Hey, how's it going? Okay. So we... go ahead.
So kind of, I have to say, around 2016 or so, my writing took on a different... tone, certainly shifted into a higher gear, because now rather than writing about myself, it was more, I had more of an interest in writing about my environment and the system. And that's when I began publishing articles through Scatolite magazine. I had this need to help people understand what prison is like, what death row is like, and how, you know, there are certainly human beings here, and that the human beings who are incarcerated, you know, deserve to be treated like human beings. But also, a lot of that writing examined the system itself, the structure of policies that impact the people behind these walls, and the kind of the community's responsibility for those policies, for the people who implement those policies. And that's kind of largely where my writing is at now. I'm kind of really focused on this idea that the public is responsible for criminal legal system policies. And if it's broken, it's because it's been ignored for so long after there is this vested interest in tough on crime, and nobody wanted to stick around for the results of those tough on crime policies. And the results are mass incarceration. The results is an aging prison population that will ultimately tax the penal resources that are available and create inhumane conditions. And we see a lot of that with COVID-19 and this call for, you know, releasing more people. But they're finding it difficult because now they don't know who to release, because the mechanisms that were in place, like a parole system in North Carolina, have been abolished. Because they got rid of those in the 90s, because they're, you know, disinvested in clemency and compassionate release programs, there's just, you know, a lot of head scratching. They're like, well, gee, what do we do now with all these people in prison and the need to reduce that number? And, you know, that's kind of where it's at right now. And there's currently this task force that's been convened by Governor Roy Cooper, and he's trying to, they're trying to put together some plans for him that can really reform this system and certainly bring about greater racial justice.
To add on to that, prisonpolicy.org says America and prison in general, the incarceration rate is 698 per 100,000, while second place, the UK, is only 139 per that same 100,000. So we definitely have a way overpopulated prison population. But what kind of policy changes do you want to see or to help fix that?
So there are a lot of policy changes that need to occur, but some of the more important ones are abolishing life without parole and the death penalty, and death by incarceration sentences, implementing second look mechanisms like parole, clemency, and compassionate release. This isn't to say that everybody who is parole eligible receives parole. I know that's kind of a myth behind parole. Just because you have a parole eligible sentence does not mean you get released. It means that you have an opportunity to prove yourself, that you get that chance to show people that you're worthy of a second chance. But if there is no second chance and there are no incentives to change, you create an environment that is going to be horrendous. It's going to be violent. It's going to be troublesome for staff, because how do you get people to obey rules when their consequences are just confinement? It won't change the situation unless you provide some kind of positive reinforcement for change. And until that mentality is altered in the way that we incarcerate people and the way that policies are developed, nothing will change. So I would like to see a difference in the way that district attorneys and judges and attorneys and definitely legislators from both sides talk about the criminal legal system. There needs to be a greater focus on restorative justice programs that involve accountability for the offender, not just in terms of confinement, but their responsibility to the victims and the victim's family. That doesn't happen in prison. That doesn't happen. It's something that is in the juvenile justice system, but it's only very slowly making it to the fringes of the adult prison system. And there needs to be a greater focus on that. If we're talking about reducing prison populations, then I strongly believe that there needs to be less focus on incarcerating nonviolent felons, people who have been convicted of drug crimes, people who are convicted of property offenses, which make up a large quantity of the people who are just in and out of prison. But when they come into the prison, they're not learning anything, because there has been a de-emphasis on programs and education and jobs training. And because there is, when they leave the system, they're worse off than they were before. So, of course, there needs to be greater focus and investment in higher education, vocational training, and mental health. If those things are not addressed, then there's very little that will change in this system.
One thing a lot of European countries do is kind of like you said, or what we should do, is focus on rehabilitation. While I feel America's prisons are very focused on just pure punishment. And I forget the stat, but it's a real high number of reincarcerations where people go out, but they can't function in the world. So they kind of have to go back because they only know prison, correct? But so I saw a study, 2018, Pew Research Center, 54% of Americans favor the death penalty and 39% oppose. So while that is closer than it used to be much more drastic, what do you say to these people that want the death penalty?
So a lot of people that want the death penalty. My understanding of why they want the death penalty is largely retributive. You know, that whole idea of an eye for an eye, you know, you kill somebody, we kill you, sort of justice. And that just, it doesn't work in a democratic country that is supposed to be about justice. To them, I would say maybe in the idea of retributive punishment, there is a belief that doing so will, I don't know, justify it. It's kind of hard to speak out against somebody's belief. You know, they have their beliefs. I can't take that away from them. What I would suggest is that the death penalty just isn't applied fairly. And by fairly, I mean there have been a number of over 165 innocent people have been removed from death row. And that's just, you know, unconscionable. How many are the people that remain on death row? How many are innocent? How many who've been put to death are innocent? And so when you apply that, you know, retributive mindset to that, the two don't mesh, because you who support the death penalty cannot be sure that the people who are in prison who are under a sentence of death are actually guilty, because there are so many tricks to the trade that prosecutors use to gain convictions. There is a lot of inadequate and ineffective defense counsel who represent indigent clients. And there's, again, no guarantee that the evidence that is proof of innocence will actually be presented to a jury, because this is not how the rules of evidence work. And a lot of the times when you see a capital trial, it's not about the facts. It's almost never about the facts. It's about who has a stronger narrative. And it's almost always the prosecution, because they hold all the resources. They have all of the experts, all of the law enforcement, and, you know, kind of the rules favor their adversarial approach. And while it's claimed that people who are in the defendant's seat have the advantage because you're allegedly innocent until proven guilty, it's just not so. And then you were just talking about the people who actually make it to death row. Everybody that's charged with murder does not make it to death row. And a lot of the people who don't make it to death row, their crimes are not any less than the people who make it to death row. They're not even worse, not always worse than the people who make it to death row. And there's really just an arbitrary pursuit of the death penalty. So again, it kind of undermines the whole argument of retributive punishment, which is what the death penalty is. There's no deterrence, no general deterrent effect in it. It costs more than long-term incarceration. And other than being arbitrary, it's frequently sought against minorities disproportionately, in fact. And a lot of the problems that are currently rife with capital punishment have been in place as long as the sentence has existed, because you cannot sentence somebody to death without a death qualified jury. And that almost automatically biases the jury towards a death sentence. So those are just some of the really basic arguments that I would say to people who support the death penalty. And in North Carolina alone, if we really want to talk about all of the problems, there's a reversal rate of 71% of every death sentence since 1972. And that means 71 of all death sentences sought in North Carolina are overturned on appeal because of errors. Errors by prosecutors, errors by jurors, errors by judges, and errors by attorneys. And that doesn't support a punishment that you can't take back. Once you kill somebody, it's over. And if you kill them and there were mistakes that brought you to that point, what are you going to, I mean, you can't, what are you going to say? You're sorry? Well, that it doesn't work. So yeah, that's probably what I'd say to them.
I used to support the death penalty when I was younger. Just it made sense, you know, an eye for an eye. But when I started doing the research and looking into it more,
you have 60 seconds remaining.
What Lau was saying about how it's not actually what the people think the death penalty is or how they think it works is not how it actually works. And one of the things I found out that was most shocking to me is I had this idea that the death penalty is used for the worst of the worst crimes. You took all the murders and picked out the worst ones. Those are the people who would be sent to death row. And what I found out is that that is absolutely not true.
You have 30 seconds remaining.
There are people on death row who've been convicted of some really horrible crimes, but there are a lot more who've been convicted of very common murders. And there are even people on death row who never killed anyone at all, who were accomplices to murder when their co-defendant killed someone and they wound up on death row while the co-defendant, the actual killer didn't. So the way that the death penalty is applied is arbitrary. It's almost like a lottery system. And a lot of it has more to do with what county a person is in or what county the crime occurred in and what the political climate of that county is, more so than what the crime was. So for example, in North Carolina, we have counties where no matter how terrible a murder is, the district attorney will never pursue the death penalty because it's just not politically advantageous to convict someone. And it's also very expensive to do a capital trial and to put someone on death row. And then we have a county right next to some of those counties where the district attorney will always pursue the death penalty for every murder, regardless of what it is, every first degree murder, because in that county, it's very politically advantageous to pursue the death penalty. The voters love it. And so the district attorney will keep going after the death penalty. So one of the statistics I found out that really shocked me was that most death penalty cases in the United States only occur in 2% of U.S. counties. And those are the 2% of counties where there's just a very aggressive prosecutor who seeks out death penalty cases, but they're not evenly applied across the country or even within certain states.
A lot of bad background bias that shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
All right, should we get Lyle back on the line?
Yeah, he's calling. Hey, I'm calling in again. Hey, Lyle. And so he just has to call back again, but he will.
All right, sounds good.
Yeah, I learned so much about death row. I had one guy in my, because I had two students in my class when I was teaching the class in the prison, who had never killed anyone. Like I said, they had been with someone during a robbery. The co-defendant killed someone. And in both cases, they wound up on death row while the co-defendant did not.
Why? That doesn't make any sense to me.
It's because there's a law in the United States called the felony murder rule. And under the felony murder rule, everyone involved in a felony that results in a murder is equally culpable. So they would charge the exact same person, from the getaway driver, the actual murderer, somebody who was there participating in the robbery. All of them are charged with the exact same crime. So it would be murder. And then if they each get separate trials, then you bring into, well, how effective are their lawyers? And so if the guy who's the actual shooter has a really good lawyer, the lawyer might get them a reduced sentence, whereas the getaway driver, and one of the guys in my class was literally the getaway driver in the murder, wasn't even in the building. And he got the death penalty. He obviously had a really bad lawyer. So those kind of things come into play. Race comes into play. The criminal background of the defendant comes into play. So if they've been convicted of previous crimes, even not involving any murder, then a jury is more likely to convict them of the murder just because they're considered throwaway people. So a lot of different things come into play, and that's where you see those completely unequal outcomes for the exact same crime, where someone less involved will get a higher sentence than someone more involved. And it's very common for that to happen.
And I'm assuming a big part of it is just even money. Like, a rich person could easily just get a great lawyer, get a small slap on the wrist, and like a poor person just absolute screwed for like something not even as close as bad or something.
Yeah, there's a saying, there's no rich people on death row.
Is it true? Or does it look? Yeah.
In this prison, they don't even have exercise equipment in where Lyle is. And prior to 2016, they were only allowed one 10-minute phone call per year.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So no exercise equipment, no activities other than card games, and they have a TV in the day room.
Do they at least get books or anything like that, like any education besides, say, like the writing part that you had?
There's no educational programs, and all of the programs, the writing programs and the other classes that were there when I was teaching have been removed. So there's no programs. They can read if people from the outside send them stuff.
Why were they removed?
Because the new warden didn't want them.
Oh my God. What about budget? Do they get a good enough budget to implement anything, or is that another problem?
You mean the prisons?
Yeah, the prisons.
That's a good question. I don't know what the budget in the prisons is, or if they have one. But the programs that we were doing, I mean, we were all volunteers. So it's not just a question of money. I wasn't paid to go in there, and neither was anyone else. It's not solely a financial problem, for sure.
You want to help?
Yeah, I wanted to help. And Lyle is back on.
Hello.
How's it going again? So
I can kind of answer part of that question. She's right. It's not just about the money. A lot of it has to do with the ideology of prison officers and, you know, whether they believe in rehabilitation or whether they believe in punishment. And unfortunately, the end of programs came about because prison administration got into place that did not believe in rehabilitation and believes that death row specifically should not have access to those kind of things.
This is even with like different topics. I did a podcast about clean injection sites. That was a topic. And by being more rehabilitative versus like punishing drug users, the diseases spread out, or even the deaths and overdoses, all that drastically reduces. Something like weed, even if you're, say, you don't like people smoking, it still reduces the people that smoke. Then I did one with prostitution and a decriminalizing sex. That one actually is airing tomorrow, well, week when this airs. And again, that drastically reduces STDs. That drastically reduces the rape and the abuse that these women face. So this, I feel like, just fits into that same category of, if you give a helping hand versus like punishing, you'll probably see the prison rates going down, and you'll probably see better reform coming out versus, like you mentioned, a lot of people want to just like go back or stuff like that.
Right. So, and this kind of speaks to the European model of confinement. They're more interested in providing that helping hand, that positive reinforcement that encourages growth and change in behavior. And that's just not the way it is in American prisons, or if it is, it's in very few prisons, and it's more, you see it more in juvenile corrections. And the unfortunate thing is you can create all kinds of statistics and studies and reports that prove these things, and you can bring them to the policymakers who have the power to implement them. But it just doesn't seem to sell. People are kind of wholly interested in that punitive mindset in prison, that they believe the prison is a place where people are supposed to disappear. And I think that makes people like myself, like this book, Crimson Letters, and others, kind of gives us a responsibility to challenge that narrative, to challenge that mindset, to talk with people and get them to understand that, you know, we're human beings. A lot of people in prison, they make mistakes, some of them really horrible mistakes, but that doesn't always mean that they shouldn't be given an opportunity to prove themselves a productive member of society. The problem, the conundrum is that, you know, providing that second chance is, you know, getting people to understand why that's necessary. And that comes to really selling them on the idea of human potential.
I had this discussion the other day where a lot of people are just set in their mindset, or some people can't critically think enough to, even though, like you said, you can show them all the information and they won't flip their minds. Like for me, what flipped my mind on the death penalty is it costs at least 18 times the price of life in prison. So it just seems economically it's a function like that. And then the National Academy of Sciences of the USA found at least minimum 4% of people on death row that were killed were likely innocent. So it's just like stuff like that that you have to get past. Oh, you think eye for an eye, okay, but the evidence shows kind of the other side. You have to look at that.
Yes, I agree.
One of you mentioned it a little bit before, but what do you see with the races in death row and even prison?
You said racism?
No, racist. I didn't mean racist like that. Oh. I mean like the races, as in you said it was unjust, the proportion with, say, colored or minority people.
Right. So on North Carolina's death row, there are slightly more than half the people here are Black, are, you know, minority. But they, African Americans only make about, 18% of the general population. So that's certainly a disproportionate rate of incarceration on death row. And that number only dips a little bit for the general prison population. So if you're incarcerating African Americans at a higher rate than white people, then it's certainly disproportionate, and it certainly speaks to laws and prosecutors that target and African Americans.
One interesting statistic too in North Carolina is that 9 out of 10 of exonerated people have also been Black. So the rate of innocence among Black people in prison is also extraordinarily high.
Well, my few points is, you ever hear it's, well, you know, it's better to maintain your car versus wait for it to break down and then try and repair it?
Yeah.
I feel like one of the things with prison is, like you said, a lot minority or a lot Black or Latino or anything like that. If we put education in the first place, like there's a history of redlining and like systematic racism and stuff like that that caused this like low poverty. And when you're in poverty, you have to do some crimes. But if we put education, or if we put better living conditions or better settings, it'll be sort of that fix the car before it has to break down and commit a crime type deal.
That's definitely a good analogy. That's actually kind of the basis for prison abolition. You get rid of the need for prisons and punishing people by addressing their concerns before they commit crimes, which means you build up the school systems, which have been deteriorating for decades, which means you provide economic relief for cash-strapped communities that are in urban centers where a lot of crime occurs. You decriminalize things like prostitution and drugs, and you build up communities and the people who live in them so that there's less of a need to punish after the fact. That's what prisons do. They're kind of a reactive process to these things that lack in the community. And that's how you reduce prison populations. That's how you get rid of these institutions. That's how you abolish the death penalty. That's how you get away from this need to reacts to crime and, you know, proactively address the problems.
I was talking with Tessie earlier, and she mentioned there was a saying that no rich people go on death row. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, that is accurate. There's actually an interesting quote from a guy who spent 30 years on Alabama's death row before he was exonerated, by the name of Anthony Ray Hinton. And he wrote in the book, The Sun Does Shine, that capital punishment means those without capital get punished.
That's a good saying. What, yeah. I hear stories where maybe him or maybe not him or other people, they go to death row for say 40, 30 years, some long, most of their life even, and then they get proven innocent. And they get given like $40 million or something like that. And they just don't even, like, they don't want it. It's not worth the time.
I don't know about anybody that's ever won $40 million after an exoneration. What I do know is that there are a lot of states that actively resist paying exonerees, that there are a lot of states that don't pay exonerees anything. Florida is one of those states. And as far as them not wanting the money, it's not that. I think a lot of people who are exonerated just settle so they can be done with the court system that took their life from them, so that no longer will they have to deal with attorneys or prosecutors and judges and people who have for most of their life lied and stolen their, you know, their life from them. So why would you, you know, if you're out of prison, and that is the greatest gift that there could possibly be, if you've ever been incarcerated, would you attach yourself to that same system in an effort just to get money? Money is great. Money is critical for reentry, whether you've been exonerated or you're leaving prison after a righteous conviction. Money is what makes the world go around, but is it worth, you know, putting up with the same things you've put up with the last 30 years just to get it, when it's a lot of the times just easier to settle? I think a good example of that would be Henry McCollum and Leon Brown, who were exonerated from North Carolina in 2014. They ended up settling. A lot of us really wish that there would be somebody who gets off of death row and is exonerated and takes the state to court and you know, pursues the maximum amount that they can get from them. But we also understand that, you know, that cost time, and time is precious, especially when you've spent 30 plus years on death row, and you get out, you're 50 and your health is bad, and you know, it's a lot of the time it's going to be worth less than simply just being done with the whole thing.
The max award here is $750,000, and you have to fight for that for years. It's not like you walk out of any prison with a check. In most states, you have to sue for any compensation at all, and there's often a cap. We just had an exoneration here in North Carolina after 44 years. He was finally exonerated, and yeah, the cap is $750,000 for those 44 years.
I took out a calculator real quick. That's $47 a day, which is $4 an hour.
Great.
Yeah.
To put that into context.
You'd be in prison for working.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
And they sue the state because they were unjustly prosecuted or something similar?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of the times they can't sue the state directly. They have to sue, like, the police department or the county in order to get any compensation beyond the $750,000.
Okay. I'm probably gonna wait a sec for the phone and then the phone call back before
I have 30 seconds remaining.
How many times do you need him to call back?
This is probably gonna have to be my last call.
All right, sounds good then.
I appreciate the opportunity. And you know, certainly hope that you get a lot of likes on this.
Thank you. Any last thing you want to say quickly?
He got off. Sorry.
All right. Wait, did they say the last one as in one more, or that was the last one?
That was the last one.
Oh, I thought he meant this would be my last one, as in he's going to call back. Oh, okay.
No, he only had an hour. They have the only one phone, so he has to share it with all the other guys on his pod, and he probably had written it down for an hour.
Any final message for the audience you want to share?
I would encourage people to learn more about the death penalty. It's not a topic that very many people know a lot about. And the more that you learn about it, the more shocking it is. There are just all kinds of things that you think wouldn't be possible because they don't make sense. And any person could tell that that's not fair. Like the felony murder law that we were just talking about, the fact that a getaway driver could get the death penalty while the actual shooter doesn't, and how frequently things like that happen. Or you could have the exact same crime committed in one county where they don't pursue the death penalty and another county where they do. But if you really want to learn more, we have this free opportunity where we do a book club for Crimson Letters. And during the book club, you can just sign up on my website, tessiecastillo.com. And each week, we meet 5 times, once a week. Each week, one of my co-authors calls in. So you get to meet Lyle and the 3 other men who we wrote the book with, and really have a chance at an intimate conversation with them. It's a small group, and we just do back and forth. You can ask any questions you like, and they answer them. They're really powerful conversations. And then during the 5th meeting, we talk about how to get involved in death penalty issues. So I really encourage people to do that, since it doesn't cost anything. And it's a really amazing experience.
Sounds good. For the audience, be sure to do that. Again, this is The Way Podcast. To find more, go to podcasttheway.com. This is FM 91.7 WHUS Stores at the top of the hour. And as always, deuces.